thorough an investigative work, I thought, in trying to present Billy Meier and the Billy Meier story. And in the tapes also, you have a lot of the footage that Billy Meier took with his little movie camera. They put their television cameras on the screen in Billy Meier's house, and that's right. the pictures you're getting.
Mm-hmm. Because I've actually seen the tape.
Mm-hmm.
My neighbor has it.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed it to me on New Year's Eve. And I used to work for a TV studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be an audio tech and camera tech. And observing the tape, there's too many cuts. I don't know if you've really taken a close look at it, but when you look at the foreground, where the spaceship was in a particular center screen, and then all of a sudden it vanishes, and it explains in the tape that it's in hyperspace, or it takes off.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually watch the foreground, there is trees. You always make sure there's trees or bushes somewhere, and the bushes are moving, and the tree has a limb in there that's moving pretty rapidly. And then all of a sudden, as soon as that spaceship or whatever that was supposed to be disappears, I mean, the split second, there's no movement in that tree. Zero. Which is an indication that somebody either spliced it or somebody just, you know, by taking a camera, whether video or movie camera, putting it on a tripod, you can shoot footage and then stop footage and remove anything out of that screen that you want, and then continue and make it look as if it disappeared.
And some of the cuts that are seen in there, it's explained in the film that the person who developed the film for Billy Meier helped himself to little bits and pieces of the film along the way. And they point out in there where to be looking for those, where it happened. In one of the pictures where the ship dematerializes at one point, I think Billy Meier's in the picture himself as he kind of walked up the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in one position and it appears in the other. If you get a good stop frame action, there's a very interesting thing happens there. As the ship is dematerializing, at one point, it's beginning to materialize at another point on the tape, which you can't do cutting film.
Well, no, but I tell you, it's very interesting. I used to do a lot of this stuff years ago when we were experimenting with video. When I was in communications, radio, and television, we didn't really have video that much. This is back in the late 60s and in the early 70s. Video was just coming to effect. And we used a lot of 16 millimeter and 35 millimeter stuff.
Yeah, this was 8.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, what I'm trying to say is that by shooting against a screen, in other words, if you have, I could very simply go out with my camera, my Super 8, and take pictures of or footage of somebody out in the field, then and showing a lot of sky above me. Or above that subject, developing it, shooting it back on a screen, on a regular Super 8 movie projector and screen,
mm-hmm.
then take a vid.
You're going to be affecting the waves that are there about the craft, and she's sitting there floating back and forth across the natural ground. So that's her pivoter point, and that's one of the other things that we do have a lot of pictures of all over the world. If you see it, a craft hovering and it's still, it seems to be next to a tree or something else that they can go ahead and ground the craft to keep it at a still position.
Well, it works a little bit like a boat would, actually.
That's exactly what you're doing when you're having a grounding force. You've latched it onto something. It may be vibrating within the frequency they're using because they're setting it up. But that appears to be a better answer than saying, I put my model up there, because I've been over there, and Billy's not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
He has no... this is just information he's getting out. More astounding of this, part of the movie was filmed by somebody else besides Billy. There are other tapes of the same craft on 8mm film.
Why is it... If you know, my question is, why is it always an 8mm film? Why is it always an Instamatic camera? Why is it always something other than
good equipment.
Quality equipment.
It's all spontaneous. They aren't sitting down there posing it, and here's Billy without any money. What was his economic situation?
Well, now, wait a second. Who's making all the money then?
Nobody. Billy's not.
Somebody's got to be making that money. Those tapes are not cheap.
Pardon?
People are paying $60 or $70 or $80 or $100, as much as $100 for those tapes.
Well, that's for...
Now, you and I both know that a video cassette only costs an average of $7 to $8.
That's the business decision of Genesis to do, but they also spent a lot of time in doing the research, right?
Well,
and they spent some money doing over there, so you can't begrudge them from doing what they want. They have an economic goal. That's what they want.
I believe that a person should make a profit or should make money. I'm not, you know, but I'm saying for someone, the way it was brought to me, my neighbor said, this man is not making a dime. Why would he lie? Why would he go through all this? Somebody's got to be making money. And when there's profit to be made, if there's a chance to stretching it a little bit to the truth, you know. And
well, we had Lee Elders on, who has produced that tape, about 6 weeks ago. And he went into the economics about it. Genesis, actually it was his other company, had spent a lot of money in the investigation of it, and sure, they needed to recoup some money.
Sure.
And so they are using this Nippon tape in order to do that. There are some rights involved where... but Billy Meyer just doesn't get anything out of it.
Well, it's just that it was just hard. It's kind of far-fetched, but, you know, the way it was brought forth to me and the way I understood it to be is that nobody was making any money, and it was just being done to show... the realism.
I would say it's still something that's deeply in the red as far as the money that's been spent in investigating it.
I just look at it, it's a matter of economics. If you had a million people interested in it, the tape's price could be dropped down to, you know, substantially. I think that, again, it's an economic situation. And who pays for the research? I do my own. I don't ask for anybody. I just go do it. When we're asking... for somebody else that maybe does not have the wherewithal to go do it, where do they get their money? They either have to create something that you're talking about.
Sure, most definitely.
And the cost to do these things spread over a few items, 100 tapes, is a lot different than maybe 10,000, right?
Well, I just don't know how many people are actually buying them. I mean, I know that there's books out now, and from what I understand, there's pictures of the Palladians or something in it.
That's true. That's volume two, which we have available.
Okay, now, this is my biggest question, and this is got to think about it for a second now. If all of this is coming down to the Palladians wanting people to know about them, then why is it, again, are we taking pictures with Instamatic cameras and stuff, and why isn't this being, if they're allowed to be photographed with 35 millimeter or Instamatic cameras or whatever it is, why aren't they being allowed to be put on film? Pictures of them actually moving, talking, and all that. That's a question I just don't understand.
That conjecture between all of us, it's they're basically observing us and seeing what's happening. Again, they're able to communicate with people that are a lot simpler in their, you know, mental abilities, per se, not digesting things. I'm not saying that Billy is ignorant. He's very street smart. It's just that he didn't have the economics to go out and buy himself a new video camera. And I don't remember too many people having video cameras 10 years ago anyway.
Well, they've been around on the market since 1972, 1973.
They were very
expensive, correct. But the fact still remains is you still had, back then I had 8mm Super 8 sound.
Well, your point being it would have been a lot nicer for him.
Why aren't they coming around now?
It would have been a lot nicer for him to have approached a professional cameraman who had all of the latest.
Well,
equipment.
Not even a professional. How about now? How about in the last 5 years?
Yeah.
You know, why haven't they come forth?
We're not sure that they haven't. When you're asking that question, we were... previously, when you're talking to Wendell Stevens and he was discussing our case in South America with the hybrid baby, we were closing in on the position where they were going to allow us to go down and have ABC film the liftoff.
And you and I were going to go?
That's right. We were going to go down. But unfortunately, we had a termination of somebody. He'd had an accident.
And
it didn't happen.
We were set to go, however.
We are working on another case that we may be allowed to do in Canada, as a matter of fact. And we're waiting now. It's supposed to be the next few months. And we may be allowed to go do that. And when we are, and they are making the allowance, we aren't the one that's dictating the terms. They're telling us what's going on.
Well, I tell you, I wish you all the best of luck. I really do. I keep an open mind.
Good for you.
I'm skeptical. You know, I'm very skeptical. I looked at this tape that my neighbor had with an open opinion, with skepticism.
There's another tape that follows that that deals with the rocket mineral samples and the alloy, and it features Dr. Marcel Vogel at that time at IBM, and he's one of the leading minds in the world about that, and you get a chance to look at those alloys with 2 million magnification, and he'll explain explicitly how that could not have been done on this planet.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your...
All right, Jay. Good question.
Thank you.
Good to have you aboard tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open.
Yes. Hello, Bill and Mr. Green.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make a few statements, and then I'll get to my question.
All right.
I've been researching and investigating the subject for over 30 years now, so it's taken up quite a bit of my time. In the early days, I'm going back to the early 50s, I was fortunate enough to meet a lot of the early day contactees. And I invariably found that the contactees themselves got some of the best photographs. Some of them took film. A large segment of the public is not aware of some of the film that some of these contactees took with 8 and 16 millimeter cameras. And it's quite good. Some of it even rivals some of the pictures that Billy Myers has taken. Some of the people who took this film were people like Dan Fry, Paul Villa. George Tamsky took a very good film in Mexico. I hope someday to get copies of some of this film and commit them to videotape. Then people can compare what they see in some of these films with what they see in the Myers film and with any new film that comes out. Now, my question is directed to Mr. Green, and I was wondering if he thinks whether our Air Force, our scientists, have gone far enough in their study of the propulsion systems to have developed and tested some of their own anti-gravity craft.
My estimation is that they are doing that right now. And they have been, and they've been experimenting with it. Colonel Stevens and I discussed a couple cases where we feel that some military officers have been flying the ET's craft and have blown themselves apart. The other information you're talking about, photographs, we're currently assembling photographs from all over the world, and we're coming out with some new books with Colonel Stevens' help. So we hope to have four new volumes of strictly the photographic evidence that you're talking about. I have over 500 pictures from different sightings myself right now.
I think Wendell probably has one of the largest libraries.
He has probably the largest that I know.
Yes, I worked
to the early part of this century.
Mm-hmm. I worked a little bit with Wendell when I lived in Arizona, and I saw what he had.
So that's all underway, and most likely, but it is supposition, estimation, but there is no reason why our military shouldn't be dealing with this science, or perhaps even the craft, because they certainly have some of them.
Well, there was a news article in the L.A. Times about a year ago of a General Robert Bond, who was vice commander of the Air Force Systems Command, flying an experimental vehicle over Area 51 in Nevada that blew up, and he lost his life.
That's correct.
And there are rumors, I know, that Area 51 is a testing grounds for some of these experimental craft.
It's probably the most guarded point on the face of the planet.
Yeah, our information is that it was probably a craft from the Reticula. And, and the extraterrestrials were cooperating with him. And he had been doing numerous flights with it for the first phase of their transportation, which is in the Earth zone. And then he decided to flip the switch to go to the hyperdrive and blew himself apart. That was our understanding.
That's what I suspected.
Well, we've heard that. I've had that checked out as much as you can. You can't get too near Area 51. The investigation that I've done on it, that was certainly a story we looked into, but there is also a possibility there was a stealth craft that he went down in. So we're running both sides of that coin.
Yes, I've heard that too.
But he certainly did blow himself up. And there certainly is an Area 51.
Well, thank you very much, then.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much for your call. Good call.
Okay.
And congratulations on your work, and I hope you turn up the things you're looking for.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Ben, you're on.
Hi, Bill. George?
Uh-huh.
Hi, how are you? I have always been wondering this. If in the 2,000 pages of notes that you read or looked over, if the people from the Pleiades mentioned reincarnation, and if it is at all possible, if they talked about transmigration, if it's possible to go from, say, an Earth life to an extraterrestrial life.
They do mention reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
They say it as a fact that we do go reincarnate. And we do travel from different planets, so it's quite possible that the quote word star people or whatever, that several of us are transplants from other places, and vice versa. We're going to be migrating to other places for this experience that we have.
Mm-hmm. Because I know in the Iarga book, they mention that Earth is not open to their reincarnation selection, but which led me to believe that there is such a thing as reincarnation selection, and I was really interested in that, and if they had any criteria for the souls that they do select, or is it up to the individual? I mean, can you work on this kind of thing?
It's up to the self and your evolution and what you're going to be. It's not a question that we can make a decision. You're the one that makes the decision where you're at.
Mm-hmm. All things being possible with God. And another thing I was wondering, did they talk about their way of life? Did they go into any kind of detail with that?
They described that they live pretty much like we do. They mate for life. They have divorces very rarely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an exception. They kind of program each other to know each other a little closer. They live to be about 1,000 years of our Earth time. They say we're slaves to the bracelet. You know what I mean by that?
No.
We walk around with a watch on our hand, and that's what we do.
Yeah, time.
That's right. And we shouldn't be doing that. They go to school for 70 years, approximately,
mm-hmm.
and they do things that they feel that they're naturally evolved towards. And if they do have children, it's very special, like one or two, whatever they have, and they go through the same training. They're very close on their population control. They're very selective on what they're doing. Like I say, they're inhabiting at least three planets with 25 billion of them. And they're, like I say, traveling through the universe.
From what I have read of them, they are a very spiritual people. They spend time playing in the dirt a lot, working the ground. That keeps them rooted in the very basics of nature. A love-motivated society, as it were.
And, of course, they probably know no such thing as war, strife, famine. The things that we know on Earth.
They have a great experience with it, and it almost wiped them out. And I think that it's just the reaction to a society that once was very violent.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, thanks very much, gentlemen.
All right, Dan.
It's been great. Have a nice night.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Greg, is that Gind?
Gino.
Hello, Bill. My glasses on here. It all looks like a D to me. Go ahead.
You have a nice show. I look forward to every Saturday. It's great.
Thank you.
Mr. Green, what did Air Force do with the craft at Edwards base?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Did they determine what kind of substance it was made of? Like maybe a crystal and metal substance-like? the middle?
All that information was classified.
Still is, then?
Well, as far as I know. I don't even have any idea where the craft is at. I'm sure that they moved it from Edwards.
Yeah.
For those who want to know just a little bit of background on that question, that maybe were not with us earlier in the show and talking about our guest tonight, George Green, when he was in the Air Force stationed at Edwards Air Force Base many years ago, he did indeed poke his head into a hangar that he probably wasn't supposed to and saw a flying saucer in there. And is talking about it.
Yeah.
And we thank you for that, George.
And also, George, have they incorporated the information that they found? Have they done anything with that to benefit us somehow or use in their programs, space programs or something like that?
Are you talking about our government now?
Yeah. Have we benefited from what we've found?
Doesn't appear that way. We just got to be blowing some people up with a space launch.
Yeah, I know. So they, you don't know of anything.
No, the definition that we were discussing at that time was that the craft was iron-powered, would not work in this atmosphere, and that we were working on craft that would fly in the outer atmosphere. So I would expect that the engineering staff that was assigned up there was probably working and doing what they were doing. I was assigned to several secret projects up there that we were working on our craft. And I just happened to be out there at that time because I was at that time working with the X-15 project and ended up there with a hangar with another craft out there. And I didn't think anything about it because we had a lot of strange birds.
Yeah. Do you think they're trying to simulate some of the materials out in space in the space shuttle somehow? Maybe experimenting, trying to come up with some kind of material that they've made the spacecrafts out of?
Again, the same problem that I have, you haven't been on earlier, is when we go for analysis of materials, we may be able to get close to what it is, but we aren't able to restructure the material with our current technology. It appears that a lot of this is very simple, and as we talk with John Bedini and stuff, he's working on certain waves and waveforms right now that can actually change the molecular structure of metals and or materials, which may be close to what the ETs are telling us. And I, like I said, we have a lot of clues, but they're not giving us the complete schematic of how they put it together.
Okay. Well, I was just curious, and I thought maybe you could tell us.
Well, I hope we got you a little further down the road of your curiosity there, Gino.
Yeah. Well, I'll just keep on going to Alexander, too, and see what I can find over there.
Well, you'll find a lot.
Yeah, I've seen you over there. I finally know what you look like now.
All right.
That's great. So, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gino. Appreciate you getting in here.
Bye-bye.
How's it?
Is titled The Secrets of Flying Saucer Propulsion by Noel Huntley. And in it, he describes a couple of experiments done by our people. And I'll just describe them briefly here. In other words, are we getting UFOs? This is what this is about. It says here, John Searle's flying disc, which appear to be a similar propulsion system to Carr's ideas, has achieved successful flight with large models for some time now. Newspaper articles have shown photographs of his saucers in flight over fields in Warwickshire, England. Searle's flying discs apparently do most things a real flying saucer can do. In 1950, he was experimenting with slip rings and built a segmented disc rotor. In 1952, it is reported that while testing a model using a generator for power, the disc broke its connections and rose to a height of about 50 feet and hovered, surrounded by a pink halo. This halo effect indicated ionization of the air at low pressure. It appears that the Searle effect involves the creation of a vortex which is tuned into the natural cosmic vortices of space, in particular the anti-gravity spiral, see chapter 13, which I did. And then here's another one. Townsend Brown, a brilliant American physicist, developed an electrogravitic system that resembled a true saucer propulsion. According to reports, discs 2 feet in diameter were made to fly around a central pole at about 12 miles per hour, and they were attached to this pole electrically and supplied with 50 kilovolts. And further development involved 3 feet discs energized by 150 kilovolts, and these were so impressive as to be highly classified. So the impression I'm getting from that last phrase where it says highly classified, as soon as you figure out how to do it, then right away it's top secret.
That's true. In fact, one of my dear friends just became top secret this last week, and I don't know where we'll ever see him again.
Well, my impression has always been that the Russians and the Americans are in a race to get this technology. They each know something of what the other is doing, but they sure don't want to be beat. So I think it becomes highly classified, and it's no mystery to me that all the information disappears right away, because that would almost be like wartime, where things are highly classified, because suppose we could show up with a whole bunch of these over Nicaragua or someplace like these, we'd carry the field right away.
Wouldn't it be better to use that technology for the benefit of man rather than the scaring of the pants off man?
Well, that's exactly it. Now, these higher-level people would want to do that, and my approach would be propaganda first. They're better at propaganda than we are, and the military, of course, wants to do it the old-fashioned way, the traditional Earth way, and they want this technology to do it with, of course.
Well, you can't blame them, and I'd rather them have it than the other guy. So, you know, there's always two sides of that coin. Do you have a question for George or John?
Yes. I have a photograph of somebody in Brazil, which I don't know if it's authentic or not, and I just want them to come, and I'll try to describe what this ET looks like. It's supposed to be one who crash-landed there, and they befriended the natives and lived with them, and the head looks just like ours, except it's somewhat rounder. The eyes are very large and round. They seem to be more open than ours, and the ears are pointed. Do you have any idea what they look like? In other words, they got pointed ears like Mr. Spock on Star Trek, so I wondered if it was copied from that.
Do you have any idea how tall this individual is? That is the most common ET, I think, that we have seen in what we would call dire circumstances. They had problems with our radar, which would lock on and interfere with the operation of their craft, so they crashed the most. I think they corrected that problem. They thought it was a hostile action on our part, and wasn't. But the reticulans are the ones that whose bodies we have most of, and that we've been able to deal with most of.
Any word about the pointed ears?
That's a part of their makeup, yeah.
Oh. Okay, well, that was my question. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, Boris. Thank you for that call.
Okay.
And we have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, gentlemen. I want to commend you on your efforts to educate us in a higher plane. I agree with everything you're saying, and at the risk of becoming top secret, I've been trying to explore the alternatives. I was very upset to see the Challenger blow its seams, but at the same time, I think it is a good learning experience for us.
If that's what happened, Bob.
Yeah, well, a great learning experience, especially for the young kids, because they are so accustomed to non-reality, and that really shocked them back to a situation. Also, our ego scientists, they are going to have to go back to the drawing board. And if they already don't know about anti-gravity or independent gravity, it's as simple as what the other gentleman was saying. I think his name is John. He was talking about using 100% of this this energy, free energy around us, and it's really radiation on a lower vibration, what we would call ultraviolet. And when it's applied in a vortex with opposite. Would be, you know, opposite and equal forces being clockwise and counterclockwise. You get a common center. It radiates from a common center out in every direction. It's just like two magnets. You put them together, and they're trying to repel each other. Well, that energy breaks down into different dimensions, and what happens is the whole craft itself is vibrating at such a high rate of speed, it nullifies any kind of, let's say, common vibrations of mass that's relating to a planet. So this is why they appear to be different colors, because they're actually going through different levels of independent velocity or vibrations. And this is, I think, will interest Mr. Green. Is I have the reason I know about this is because I've been reading a lot of books. But I have a photograph that was taken by a friend of my father's out in the desert near Edwards during the early 50s. And when he took this photograph with a very clear color wide-angle lens, he didn't see anything, and yet it showed up very clear. As one of the clearest photographs I've ever seen. You don't see the metal of the ship, but the whole outline of the ship is there. It's a scout craft, and those are like our shuttle, except they, you know, they're more advanced. Obviously, they go from the planet's surface to a mothership. Those are the larger cigar-like looking crafts. They're more the research vessels that hold all the supplies and what have you, but It's in a very intense color. It's almost like a golden white, and the sky around it is a smoggish color, and the plant life is recording a blue, so that would mean a cold magnetic force is being passed not only through the air but through the plant life. And the most interesting thing to me is their common horizontal is now vertical to our planet at this stage, and it's hovering right in front of the photographer. This guy didn't. He claims he didn't see anything, so there was a cloaking effect going on. But it's really just it's just like our eyes don't pick up every vibration, our ears don't pick up every sound. We can only receive so much. We're limited. But I've been waiting to get on all night, and in fact, I've been working on people individually. And you know, I must sound like a rambling off at the mouth.
No, actually, Bob, you're not. I'm sitting here listening, and so is John Bedini, sitting across the table from me, just agreeing with most everything that you've said. John is one of our scientists in this country who has harnessed that free energy thing that we've been looking for. He has them in his laboratory.
Great.
And you'll be hearing more about that. John, you have any comments on some of the observations that Bob made would seem to be right on?
Yeah, we just something to throw in here. I think you're familiar, Bill, with this new amplifier we created.
I certainly am.
With the where we took the old normal silicon devices, which are normally known as the common transistor, and now we're making them work in a new wave range, which is in the ultraviolet range. And these things actually glow in the dark. You can see them emit the ultraviolet greenish light, bluish green. All right.
Yeah. They're considered the finest amplifiers in the world.
And that thing is vibrating at real high speed, but it's a non-linear device, just like you're talking about.
I see.
And it's what's left over that is the free, and if you capture that while you're on your way, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a matter of transmitting the cyclic energy. Of how you apply that energy into your motor drive, it has to be a complete cycle. I mean, our cars are completely inefficient. We've got about 8 or 9 different cycles we apply till we get to that one cycle, which we call a wheel. It's pretty funny, if you ask me. In any case, I do have this photograph, and if you're interested, I could pass it on to Mr. Pedini and Mr. Green. I don't know if it would be of any interest to you.
It would be of great interest to us,
okay.
Bob.
All right. Well, I'm glad I was able to get on, and you don't know how many times I've been turned down on other talk shows, and in fact, this show has been recommended to me by other people that I've cornered and practically scared to death, and then really helped them to see a lot of things for what they are, and I'm going to try and work on a remote-controlled ship sometime this year, so look for that.
Well, Bob, thank you, and I couldn't think of a better call to cap off our 3 hours tonight. Appreciate it very much.
God bless you all. We'll see you soon.
I hope so.
Take care.
And that's it. George Green has been with us, our guest, talking about E.T. On the phone from Tucson, Arizona, Wendell Stevens, and in studio, John Bedini, talking about spacecraft propulsion. I hope it was an interesting night for you. Kevin Ryerson will join me next week, and perhaps we'll hear from Tom McPherson while he is here. So join us then.
K-A-B-C.